Buddy, thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of Living Deliciously. I am your podcast hostess, Dabby Longlegs, and today I have a special guest, Laura Marie River Peace. Laura Marie makes zines like The Trike Diaries and enjoys the intersection of disability and sexuality. She lives in community and helps run the Las Vegas Radical Mental Health Collective. She also does interfaith peace work and anti-nuclear work, as her ancestors were unjustly harmed in the Trinity bomb tests in New Mexico. Laura Marie also writes a lot and enjoys making visual art, riding trike, ecstatic dance, and permaculture. You can learn more about Laura Marie and follow her work at www.listeningtothenoiseuntilitmakessense.com, on Facebook at facebook.com/listeningtothenoiseuntilitmakessense, and on Instagram at username xtrikeslutsx. Hi, Laura Marie.
Hi, Debbie. Pleased to meet you.
Nice to meet you again, too. Thank you so much for being here today.
Sure, happy to be here.
Yeah. So I would love to dive right in because like I've seen some of your zine work. And so I would love to talk about like how you got into zines. I know that there's like vaguely, like I have like a vague understanding of like some of the history behind zines, and maybe not everybody in the audience like knows what they are. So would you be down to educate us?
Absolutely. So zine says I enjoy them are DIY, homemade, independent publishing. Some people still do cut and paste with literal scissors and glue sticks like I do, but others are more savvy and like a more polished look and use, more apps and programs for that. And then they're mostly photocopied, but some could be like printed on a press. They're mostly small run. And a lot are traded among friends or sold at zine fests or craft fairs or online. And they're a really good way for people to connect and share our truths. And I've met a lot of great pen pals through zine exchanges. There's a lot of trading that goes on. But something really special about zines is how you could hear the voices of people who often won't make it to mainstream publishing, who are doing something edgier or more creative. And as culture changes, certain things become more common and commonly spoken about. But zines are, I feel like zines are kind of on the fringe as far as like talking about things that culture mostly doesn't want to talk about. So because there's a lot less gatekeeping and there's a lot more freedom, the zinesters aren't subject to the same power fuckery that we might find in mainstream publishing. So something that wouldn't have a wide appeal to a mainstream audience can still be zined about. And that's really wonderful, that freedom.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really powerful to bring up too, especially because like right now, something that we're seeing so much is like internet censorship, especially on social media. And so it's like what I'm hearing is like a big key word here is like access, like making this art form accessible, and it's like so deeply meaningful and it's subversive and like there's an important message that's getting out with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I do see a lot of censorship where people are trying to make money in valid ways involving sexuality on places like Instagram, and getting smacked down for it or having to run around trying to, you know, go on another platform or things like that. It's very disrespectful. But zine making means people can say whatever we want, and because a lot of people keep it analog, you know, it's a physical paper and ink thing that can be handed from person to person or left at a bus stop or left at the library. And in that sense, yeah, it does enjoy a different kind of freedom that feels really good.
Yeah. And it's cool because it's like, there can be like an anonymity to it. Or it could be like another way for like someone to get their name out. Like you said, like something as simple as like leaving it at a bus stop.
Right.
That just reminded me of like a time that like I had a really rough day and I ended up at this coffee shop and there was like a little bookshelf next to the table that I was at. And there was a zine on it that said, "I see you." And it was just sort of like going through like difficult feelings that people might experience on a day-to-day basis and just like reassuring us that we're seen and like just remembering it like makes me feel emotional. But like that just sort of like reminds me of like the impact that like that this art can like have on people.
Yes, it could be so heartfelt and intimate. The especially like a little zine, like a mini that could fit in your pocket or in a bag. And that can be so like ephemeral. It's just a piece of paper folded up or bound together with staples or thread, but it can be so meaningful. Something that's almost worthless to someone could be almost priceless to someone else. And it's true. A common thread in zinery is putting our hearts into it. Mm-hmm. Most of the people who I trade with make per zines, which are like personal zines. So it's a lot, it's mostly a lot of women and non-binary people spilling our hearts out. And it's very intimate and beautiful and a level of honesty that is not often shared because there can be the anonymity or it can be a way to like put your name out. Some people do use it as like a stepping stone toward wanting something like book deals and something bigger, but then some people also love it for exactly what it is, you know, like that small scale, you know, usually much thinner than a book, usually only like 20 pages or so, and how sweet that can be.
So how long have you been making zines for?
I started making zines when I was in high school, and I started making zines when I was a freshman in high school. So I've been making zines for 32 years. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Yeah, thank you. It started out, I had a friend at a different school who made a zine. And then I started my own and I continued it for all 4 years of high school. When I was a kid, I talked about menstrual extraction and other ways to have control over our bodies and our right to choose. I talked about protest. I talked about anarchy and freedom and a lot of things that meant a lot to me even then that still mean something to me. And then as the years went on, during grad school, I made a poetry zine that was really playful and fun and a bit subversive considering the seriousness of the program that I was in. And then I started making almost like newslettery, like personal family news kind of zines. And then I started Functionally Ill, which was one of the first zines that really mattered to me, which is about radical mental health. I started it 15 years ago when I was first diagnosed bipolar 1 with psychotic features. And that zine I've been making ever since. I've been making that zine for 15 years and it's changed along with me. And I've talked about the different parts of my journey of mental health and radical mental health. So that zine covers it all. And I think I have every single issue still available in print. It's up to, I think I'm on issue about 32. I make about 2 issues a year. I cannot hear you, Dabby.
Oh,
there,
can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay, I said that's impressive.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
It means a lot to me. I love that zine. So when my diagnosis was changed, I talked about that when I tried to get on benefits and spent time with Social Security. I talk about that when my mom died. There's a really thick issue, like a 2-part issue about my mom's death. there's an issue about my dad's death. I've talked about autism and autistic liberation. I've included a lot of my life in that zine. It's really important to me. But so I did that. I do that one still. I have a poetry zine called Hat Genius that's on about issue 24. I have the Trike Diaries zine that means a lot to me. And then a lot of other ones. There's one called Lost Child that's autobiographical. Alphabet. It's an alphabet zine. So for every letter of the alphabet, there's a vignette that's autobiographical. And I have a couple of vegan cook zines. And I have a gardening zine and a permaculture zine. Oh, I have a special treehouse for fat people that's about fat liberation. So it's a lot of different things and some one-offs. I just made one called How Not to Domestic Violence Anyone. That's about not doing domestic violence to anyone. And that's a mini, but I've had some really good feedback so far.
That's so cool. So I love how it's like, it's also like an opportunity to like, kind of like put like your own like biography, your own like memoirs into this like art form. So when you do this, like, is it strictly writing or like, do you also like illustrate it or do you put like photos in it and kind of make like a collage?
Mostly it's been writing and drawings. And at first I would get other people to do the drawings because I didn't have faith in my visual artistic abilities, but now I mostly do my own art. And it's mostly black and white line drawings. I was working on one yesterday that's a mad map. So it's about kind of identifying where I'm at emotionally and then the things that help me with when I'm having mental health struggles. And that one's gonna be in color. So that's kind of exciting.
That is exciting.
Yes. And I always bind my zines with thread because when I was a young person, I had a long arm stapler and it broke and I was living in poverty and I couldn't figure out how to fix it and I couldn't buy a new one. So I started binding my zines with thread because I would drink tea and there was the little thread that connects the bag and the tab. So I would save those threads and poke holes and then bind it with the T-string thread. That was really special to me. And it sometimes you can kind of smell the tea and it smelled good.
I love that so much. I love how it's like repurposing something. So it's like more earth friendly, but then also it's like, I don't know, like to me, like as kind of like a witchy person, I'm like the idea of like taking something that you like drank, that you like consumed, and then like having its essence go into like another art form. Like, I don't know, I find that kind of like magical in a way.
That's beautiful. I love that perspective. I hadn't thought of the magic of it, but I feel like I do see the magic interwoven all over the place too. Mm-hmm.
So I know that you mentioned like one of like the big topics that you cover is like the intersection of like sex and disability and like mental health. And so I would love for you to expand on that more if you're interested.
Oh yeah, I'd love to. I guess I mentioned that my mom died. That was a little over 2 years ago. And when she died, I bought myself a trike. I bought myself an adult tricycle because I'd wanted one ever since I first knew they existed. And when my mom died, I lost my belief in the world as a safe place. I thought that the world was no longer really worth being in and I could never be safe again. So when I bought that trike with some life insurance money, and I started riding every day with my spouse in our neighborhood, I learned so many things. I learned what my legs are for. I strengthened them very much by riding trike. I learned how to move through my neighborhood with power because I wasn't afraid because I could go a little faster than I can walk. And I also learned that I could have control over my fun because when I was a child and I rode bikes with the neighborhood kids. I was super domed by boys who they controlled everywhere we went and everything we did and the level of risk that we took. And I was just kind of along for the ride and felt like really sad about that. But once I was riding a trike and I had the power, it helped me learn how to have power in my body. And that was extremely useful at a time when I felt powerless after my mom's death. So riding that trike changed my life. It helped me feel healthy, like a different type of health for the first time in decades also. I'm disabled in multiple ways, but the trike, because it's three-wheeled, it's a little stabler. But I heard people talking shit about riding trike. They said it was like cutesy and twee and like for old people, and they looked down on it. And I was like, fuck that. Riding trike is sexy as hell. I love riding trike. And if people want to try to eliminate erase my sexuality by saying I'm disabled or I'm crazy, fuck them. I love trike as to me, the symbol of the intersection of disability and sexuality. So that's why it's so powerful and why I love it so much and why I got kind of trike addicted. Like I had to go every day or I didn't feel right for a long time. And it helped me learn about my neighborhood where Ming and I live in Las Vegas. I learned about trash. I started doing guttermancy, but I learned about the future and the culture that I live in from the trash that I encounter in the gutters. I like to check out all the dumpsters because I'm also a dumpster witch in addition to a trike witch. I love my neighborhood at dawn. That's when we would mostly go. So we would see the trash that people dropped in the night and sparkling glass as the sun rose, sparkling all over the street and the sidewalks and the vacant lots. And in the boarded up houses, it's very beautiful. It's so real, Debbie. It's the most real thing in the world to see the poverty in the morning sunlight sparkling there as I ride my trike with power in my whole body. It's very, very nourishing for me. And I would recommend riding trike to anyone who can manage. Mm-hmm. You could go as slow as you want when it's 5:30 in the morning, especially because no one's really out.
Honestly, you are inspiring me to get a trike because it sounds like less stressful than riding a bike, but like you're still like moving your body and, you know, you're getting an opportunity to like explore while like still going faster than like just walking, like you said. Yes. And just like the way that you described like going through your neighborhood, that's something that like, I don't know, like it's very... like me, myself, like going through like my neighborhood, there's always this sort of like childhood nostalgia of just like exploring your neighborhood and exploring like the city that you live in. And there's just something so magical about it. And like, and the way that you describe it, it just sounds like so embodied and it sounds like so present. And like, that's just so beautiful that like you're able to like cultivate that for yourself.
Yes, thank you. That's a very accurate reading of what I have told you of my experience. And I can't wait until the zines I sent you come in the mail and you could read about it too.
Yeah. And I also like, I love it too, because it's like it's really just like making it your own. And I feel like that's kind of like a big part of like navigating sexuality and like health issues, whether they're like physical or like mental health issues. It's like figuring out how to like navigate the world in a way that like that works for you and like making it your own and like saying fuck you to the haters. I find it so beautiful how you've like created that for yourself.
Thank you. Yes, I see radical mental health as holding on to a big part of radical mental health is holding on to my personal power as much as I can and as long as I can. So that empowered feeling that I'm enough and I'm okay. And it doesn't matter what judgments the world's going to put on me or doctors are going to put on me. What matters is like the truth that I know and the community that I form. That is a common thread among a lot of what I do. So I feel like riding that trike, if some asshole yells out his truck window something about my fat ass, it doesn't feel the way it used to feel when I was young. And mostly they're asleep at 5:30 and 6 in the morning anyway. They're not really yelling that much out of their trucks. But that feeling that I'm in my body matters, I'm unconditionally valid, I'm unconditionally okay, and the judgments of others aren't really my concern. That is in the trike sledding, that is in the radical mental health organizing that I do. That's even part of the interfaith peace work that I do and living in community. So that thread of like, I'm unconditionally valid. I'm not gonna accept the shame anyone tries to give me. And I'm gonna model that and then I'm gonna write about it. So I'm gonna try to share this liberation, since all liberation must be shared to be liberation, right? Because of the intersectionality of that. A liberation by my own is nothing. Like I have to like invite in the other people and model it and talk about it over and over again, really, such that the people on social media who love me probably get tired of hearing about that unconditional validity, but it's kind of a bedrock of who I am.
I love that so much. That's so inspiring. And like, I don't know, I love seeing like your posts and stuff. I'm just sort of like, living your best life. Like that's, I don't know, the vibe that I get from you. So I love that. And I think that especially like even more so with like the times that we're in, like we all need that reminder. I would love to hear more about like radical mental health, because it's like, I'm sure it's like no surprise, you know, like in the US, like the physical and like mental health care system is pretty garbage. And so what does like radical health mean to you, or like radical mental health like mean to you?
Radical mental health is definitely what saved my life when I was diagnosed first with bipolar, one with psychotic features. I was afraid of taking the medicine, so I went online because I heard about the side effects and I was scared. So I found a lot of people doing a lot of different things, and I realized that I didn't have to go along with what the doctor said and swallow that whole. I realized I had choices, and that there could be many, many tools in my toolbox where medication and doing what doctors said didn't have to be the only or the main thing that I did for myself. So that's another example of how trike riding is part of my wellness, because I don't know how many tools I have in my toolbox, but that's one of them. You know, the trike riding, ecstatic dance, living in community, making zines, making art, the delicious foods that I eat, prayer and ritual, and all of the community care and self-care things that I do. There's some peer counseling, and sometimes I like therapy if I could get a good one. But for me, radical mental health is about choices. So if you want the medicine, go for it. If you don't, let's try to, you know, do without it. Maintaining the autonomy of our bodies, being treated with consent, being in an environment where I'm the boss of myself and my life. And it doesn't matter how disrespectful a doctor or clinician is, I'm always going to respect myself. And I might have to like smile and nod to them sometimes, but I know in my heart that there's nothing wrong with me. And the differences that I have, as long as I can be honest about them and keep things in motion, like keep my feelings and my body and my spirit in motion, then I'm gonna be okay. There's still going to be hard times, but with honesty and community and love and a caring spouse and lots of movement and sunshine and Mother Earth's connection, I'm going to be okay. So it's taken a long time to learn that and to believe it. And I was really sedated on a bipolar cocktail for 12 years and sleeping a lot and not living the life I wanted. So now that I can make more choices and have more freedom, I have a lot more energy to do my life's work that my ancestors handed me these gifts and these tasks. So I have a responsibility to do that. And psych meds were not helping me do those things. Psych meds were just making me sleep a lot. And I honestly feel like I was medicated in a way that made me not a danger to myself or others, according to doctors. But I was never really a danger to myself or others. It was just, you know, they spent very little time with me, and they were going from their fears instead of going from the truth of what I'm on Earth for. They thought I was on Earth to watch TV and cry, probably. But I'm not on, I'm on Earth to do much, much different things from that.
Thank you so much for sharing that. That's like, that's so profound, because, and I feel like a lot of people can really like relate to that too, because it's like, I don't know. I remember like a few years ago when a doctor gave me antidepressants, it was very pushy and I wound up reacting terribly to it. You know, it's like the side effects can be awful. And it sort of like forced me to like create, you know, like you were saying, like your own like toolbox for like mental health. And it's like the community part of that is so important, because it's like a conversation I'm seeing a lot lately is that like we're so like hyper-individualistic, or like we're encouraged to be hyper-individualistic, but like, you know, like so many of like the things in our toolboxes like require community, like they require support, they require a supportive partner, friends, or family. Mm-hmm. And I would love to like segue that into like how you've like created like a radical mental health collective.
Yeah, thank you for asking. Yeah, community is so important. Even though I'm an outlier introvert, I need people. I need touch and communication and connection. And I feel that capitalism and the heteropatriarchy really want us isolated and separated in our own little pockets, buying our own lawnmower and our own cookie sheets, when there's so much that we could share. And so, and sharing food is such a big part of that. But I thought I couldn't really start a radical mental health collective because I'm an outlier introvert and I have social differences. But I learned that I could do it in my own way. And the collective has been going for 5 years now, meeting a couple times a month, at least for 5 years, which is really rather remarkable, considering mental health organizing as being done by people who have a lot of moods and challenges and sometimes cycles to our wellness. So maintaining something like that is pretty special. And I feel really grateful that I took the plunge and decided to start it without the ton of support that I wanted to, when I started it. So this Radical Mental Health Collective started meeting in Las Vegas at a place called Transcending the Gender Box that gave us free meeting space. It was this really nice place that doesn't exist anymore. And then we started meeting other places. And once pandemic started, we started meeting over Zoom. So we started welcoming people from all over the world. Like, it's not just Las Vegas now. But we've developed a set format. So every meeting follows this format that works pretty well for us, so that people who have social differences and different needs can feel safer within that format. It's not just a free-for-all like a party can be. It's like we kind of know what's coming, so we can relax into it. There's pretty much no small talk. It's just getting straight to the things that are really affecting us, which is wonderful for me. I love that. Yeah, talking about the real stuff right away. The meetings are an hour and a half long, so people who can't be social for a long time can still enjoy them. We have stickers and postcards, and I was embroidering patches for a while, so we have some patches. A lot of different people have come and gone, and I've loved and befriended many of these people. But the work is so dear to my heart, Dabby, because you know, mainstream medicine doesn't work very well. And a lot of people slip through the cracks. And a lot of the people who come to these meetings have been through it all, from arrest to being, institutionalized against our will, forced medicated, abuse in hospitals. So, that's on one side of the spectrum, to people who've never been diagnosed and never interacted with the system. So there's a lot of different kinds of folks who show up. But we seem to self-select. I think having the name Radical in the name means we self-select for people who are trying to do something different, want a better world, and want to be real and are willing to try something new. So we support each other in that. We listen supportively. And it's the only space in my life where I can talk. We usually have 5-minute check-ins. That's like the limit. So if someone has a timer, we actually time each other. It's usually a timekeeper. That's the only place in my life where I can talk for 5 minutes straight and feel kind of safe that I'm not like too muching someone. Like this is the parameters. This is how we do it. And having that ability to speak my truth to brilliant people who can understand it is, it's wonderful. It's so nourishing. And our attitudes about things like self-harm and suicide are very generous and kind. To be in a space that doesn't have mandated reporting, to be in a space where we're just being real and we could talk about just about anything, is very special. We've created something special. And kind of like that modeling that I mentioned, the modeling of being unconditionally okay when I ride trike or make zines, we're modeling to each other that, I hear voices, doesn't have to be a problem. When they're mean or screamy, I don't like it. But that's my life and I belong at the table of humanity. Or when someone talks about, really bad experiences with hospitals or medication side effects, just to be together telling the truth about that with other people who are also telling the truth, it's a very special kind of love, because it's a community love that's it's mostly more distant than we usually might have in like a romantic relationship or even friendship. But that group experience is like I think it's a really important kind of nourishing.
Absolutely. People need like space to just be able to be like truly themselves and to be able to be like held and like witnessed in that. And like that sharing of like radical honesty is like so healing. Have you read the book Radical Honesty before?
I don't think I read that book, no.
Oh, okay. But yeah, it kind of reminds me of like what you're saying, where it's like people just get this opportunity to like tell their truth. And I think like especially so many experiences with like mental health in like the medical world, like a lot of the times it's like people are afraid to tell their truth because they're afraid of getting institutionalized. Or like a big thing that's coming up lately is like with like ADHD diagnosis. It's like if you use cannabis, like doctors are going to make it more difficult for you to get diagnosed. So then it's like people aren't pursuing the treatment that they want or need because of, stigma and stuff like that. And it's just so healing to like have that, to just be able to like speak your truth. And And also it's like what you said about like people like hearing voices and like being okay with it. Like ironically, like I read this in like a psychology textbook, but there was like a section on like cultural differences in psychology, and they were talking about how like, you know, and like certain cultures or like certain tribes that, you know, aren't centered around Western medicine, like people who have what Western society considers like mental illnesses, and other cultures might be like regarded as like spiritually gifted and stuff like that. And I don't know, I don't think that there's like enough conversation about that anymore.
Yeah, that's so true. And I do think that people like me who are considered crazy often have a lot to offer with visionary skills of like new ways of seeing culture and doing things. Mm-hmm. And to just, you know, lock us away or sedate the fuck out of us because a doctor is too busy to do something more nuanced than that is really a shame, because it's not fair to us, but it's also not fair to the culture that the culture gets these vibrant, creative, brilliant people silenced so that the culture can't grow and become something better. But I love when people make different choices and do things that others don't understand and delight others with values and art and performance that's stimulating and isn't just, you know, regurgitation of normal radio shit. I loved something different like that. And I see that, I've seen that in you, Debbie, in your art, when I see something I've never seen anyone else do. And I'm like, oh, it's just so, it's so nourishing, like a breath of fresh air to see like an amazing, brilliant person being themselves in this empowered way. It makes me feel like I can live. It makes me feel like it's worth continuing in a world that sometimes feels like we're asked to be in such narrow spaces. And I want to help like open the space wider for more kinds of people and, yeah, more types of art and things that could, because it doesn't nourish my soul to hear like the same Taylor Swift song over and over. Like my soul is something so much deeper, and it requires like a whole other kind of authenticity that I see in the work of you, and sometimes in my own work and the work of other people who I love who are doing something different. We need it so bad.
Thank you so much for sharing that. Like, it really means a lot to me. And yeah, that's why I love having this show, because it's just like, I love bringing on people who like are radically sharing their authenticity. And, you know, whenever like I'm able to have those conversations with people, I'm just like, ah, you get it. And so, yeah, it's like the world needs people like us, even though some people might think we're crazy, but I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's an honor to be considered crazy in this world when to be normal is mostly so boring. Yeah.
Yeah. It makes me feel dead inside. Like whenever I have tried to be normal, I've always felt like I was like crushing my soul. Like I can't do that anymore.
Right.
Thank
you for liberating yourself and helping others see that, and then we can liberate ourselves too when we see that you have.
That's really like my goal with my art, is that like it will inspire people to feel like, oh, if this person is being weird, but like they're being their true self, maybe that makes it a little less scary for me to get in touch with my weird and be myself. And so that's, thank you. That's like exactly, you know, the message I want to like spread to the world. I also wanted to ask about like your ancestors and like what they went through, because you were talking about how like, you know, like they've given you gifts and you want to like share that with the world. And I feel like there's like a lot of disconnection from that, like in our modernized world lately. And I don't know, I do like to think that, you know, like in a spiritual way, whether you know, someone is ascribed to a specific religion, or they're just sort of like vaguely spiritual or connected with the universe, that like, that we do have like gifts to like share with the world and stuff. And so I would love to hear about like your ancestors' story, if you would like to share, and like, and how that's inspired you to like do the work that you're doing.
Yes, thanks for asking. So I guess I would say that I used to not care at all about genealogy. I thought it was a waste of time, and who cares about those dead people? I also had this feeling that they wouldn't like me. I had a feeling that my ancestors were a bunch of like super straight-laced people who would hate me for my queerness or my wildness or some form of my expression. But then after my mom died and I felt super disconnected from family and my roots, I was like, oh, well, maybe I'll go online and see if like anything's on here with my ancestors. I feel that ancestors don't have to be blood ancestors. They can be ancestors of ideology or ancestors of art. There's an idea in disability justice that our ancestors could be the disabled people who came before us and paved the way with justice. But these people, like here are some of my ancestors that live. This picture was taken in Carrizozo, New Mexico, which is near where that bomb test I mentioned. So this lady in the black and white dress, her name was Manuelita. And so she's there with her sisters. I don't know what they're doing. I'm guessing they had a party and someone said, hey, everybody, let's take a picture.
Yeah.
But it's cool, like, to look at their shoes and her swollen ankles, because my ankles swell up too. And to look at their style choices, their facial expressions. Manuelita's got her arms crossed, like maybe she's not that comfortable. She's kind of feeling smushed. And then this lady in the lavender next to her has this like kind of goofy grin. Kind of reminds me of me sometimes. And then some of them are kind of skinny, but then some might be kind of fat like me. So I look at them and try to see myself and my mom in there. But yeah, that bomb test I mentioned, it was the first nuclear bomb. They blew it up and they didn't tell anybody that they were going to do it. The government said, oh, nobody lives there. But mostly not that many white people lived there. And those were considered the real people, I think. But there was animals, there was plants, there was Mother Earth. And there were my ancestors hanging out in Carrizozo. And then, you know, they woke up one morning. I think they set it off like, I don't know, 5:30 in the morning. It was in 1945, I think. But the ashes rained down for days and they didn't know what it was. The ashes were falling on their livestock, falling on their gardens, falling on their houses, falling on their clothes that were hung to dry, and falling into their water supply. So all these people, that like the cancer rates for that area are, you know, out of this world. Yeah. I looked up the like the miscarriage rates for like the year after. So I've done some learning about it, and it's pretty horrific because the government knew that it was a risky thing but didn't warn or explain. So that bomb test like radioactively poisoned a lot of people. And it started the nuclear, like the whole nuclear fuckery that still continues today.
Yeah.
And because they did so much testing, there are so many people were downwind. They're called downwinders. Mm-hmm. And the cancer rates are astronomical. Lots of people dying who... So my Nana, who was my mom's mom, got a rare form of cancer when she was like 50, and she died when she was 52 of this cancer after suffering horrifically. So, you know, this is affecting a lot of families. And for the people who lived in Utah, there was some kind of justice. They got some money payments, and people in Nevada also. But the people who lived in New Mexico never got those payments. It might have been because because of being maybe browner. Most of those people, they never got the money. So there's a lot of like painful justice stuff tied in that. And it really affects families, you know, those early horrific cancer deaths and the denial that can form, and then the whole like chasing the American dream, but oops, this country just like screwed us over big time thing.
Yeah.
And the way that the trauma of the violence of the racist harm can get into people and then get stuck in weird ways and then comes out as, you know, other violences later, maybe down the line. So there are still people like me being affected by this bomb that went off like 80 years ago. People like me are still living that pain because that trauma got passed down through a few generations. So mm-hmm. that means a lot to me, and that's part of why I like to work for peace and anti-nuclearism and speak of other ways of being. But I wanted to tell you about the gifts. Yes. So I have a strong feeling that my ancestors worked very hard to stay alive and hand their gifts down through the generations. And that this love that I feel in my body, this love that makes me want to do radical mental health and be honest and connect with my spouse in a nonviolent way, and all of the truth telling and the storytelling and art making that I do, I feel that my ancestors gave these gifts to me, and they didn't stay alive for nothing. They stayed alive, you know, with really hard work to hand these gifts to me. So when I'm at my saddest times sometimes, and I think I don't want to live in this world, I think of them and how they wanted me to do this good work. And that's why they lived, so they could hand it to me. So when I light candles at my altar, when I pray, when I do visualizations to try to go back and hold those ancestors when they were little and try to heal some of this pain that's intergenerational, then I feel I have no business like checking out like emotionally or checking out like death wise. Like I want to stay as long as I can on earth to do these works, because no one else can do them for me, you know. Like I'm here to do that. And your story is a little different from mine, and my spouse's story is a little different from mine. So to tell our truths is brilliant. It's so important. And I can't get away from that responsibility, but I love it. It's not a problem, because it means like I have a reason to get up every day. You know, it's a big part of that. And I didn't have my own children. I don't have paying work. I don't drive a car. There are a lot of choices that I've made or that were made for me that make me different. But my life is worth so much because I'm choosing to do those things that my ancestors asked me to. And that's the like blood ancestors, but the disabled ancestors and the art ancestors and all those people who work so hard. I'm so grateful to them.
Mm-hmm. I love that so much. And I love the idea of like ideological ancestors and art ancestors too. Like something I hear a lot in like the queer community, for like people who are like estranged from their family or like don't have supportive family, like looking up to like their transcestors. I'm curious, like who are some of your like art ancestors?
Oh, great question. I have to admit, I have on my altar a picture of Frida Kahlo. She's got to be one of my favorites. You know, the things she said about being different and seeing those self-portraits when I was a kid and being like, how she does that? She has a monkey. She has a mustache. She's gorgeous. Can I be like her? do I want to be like her? Like all these like newness exploding in my mind. It was so wonderful to see that. And I still look at some of those paintings and still feel blown away at her honesty in some of those, like the little child holding a skeleton skull, or like just those like horrific stuff that she painted that was like disgusting, or things that was like, oh, why would you want to depict that? But then it changed my soul. It was so valuable. I needed it. I still need it. But especially when I was a kid, I needed that. And to see her and her Mexicanness, and to dream of like other ways of being and other lives with courtyards and tropical plants and the different fruits was very inspiring when I lived in this, you know, town that seems so small and broken. So she's like one of the main ones. That's a great question. I can think of more of my disabled ancestors, mm-hmm. people who were working for fat liberation and disability mm-hmm. justice, who spoke out about the way so many disabled people are locked away and hidden away. So then when the abled people say, oh, we don't need to consider those people. There aren't very many. They're just rarities. They don't matter. But then it's actually like, well, a lot of those people you're not seeing because they're in the prison or the hospital or the group home and can't really leave. So it's actually a lot of people. And if you make your shit accessible, then they'll come and you're going to have a much more diverse and valuable group of people if you include more kinds of people. Yeah. So that would be people like Stacey Milburn wrote a fantastic essay about that. I love her, and lots of people whose names I don't remember, but who did this really wonderful work. And even if I don't know their name or remember what they looked like they are my people, and they did all this, you know, for us, and we can pick it up and take it further. That's part of our responsibility, in my opinion, too.
Absolutely. Like carrying that torch forward.
Yeah.
Well, this has just been so lovely. And Laura Marie, thank you so much for sharing your story, for sharing about your art, about the work that you do. Like, yeah, I loved hearing from you, and you're just so inspiring. And we need more conversations like this in the world. We need more people doing this kind of stuff in the world. And so just thank you so much for being an inspiration and for doing what you do and for sharing your truth.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Gabby, and lots of blessings to you and your podcast and all the brilliant work that you do. And I think you are a lot younger than me. And when I see you, I hope there are many brilliant young people like you who are doing this really important work. Thank you. Thank you for doing something different.
Well, I'm like feeling all the good feels right now. I will have your information in the episode description, so in that way, if people forgot all the addresses and stuff in the beginning, they know where to look to find you and support your art. And I can't wait to receive the zines in the mail. Like, I'm so excited about it. And everybody check out Laura Marie's art. And if you're in Vegas and in need of resources, definitely check out her Radical Mental Health Collective.
Yes, so good. Thank you so much.
Well, I hope that you have a beautiful rest of your day and many, many blessings right back to you and your art and everything that you do.
Thanks, Debbie.
Have a wonderful day.
Bye.
Bye.